From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Do President Clinton and Bob Dole differ at all on foreign policy? We'll look at the U.S. in the U.N. and the Middle East. Young Democrats talk about organizing in Georgia, the home state of the most powerful Republican in Congress.
If we're going to be responsible for our own destinies and take responsibility for ourselves and our counties, in our country, in our states, we have to get involved. We have to infiltrate the process. We have to infiltrate the parties. We have to infiltrate their meetings. And we can't give up.
Professor Cornel West responds to the politics of meaning and police brutality, one way of building coalition between Latino and African American communities. All this and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. While President Clinton plays the statesman in Asia, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is planning to make foreign policy a key part of his strategy to win the November 5th presidential election. Dole is already making attacks on Clinton's foreign policy record, a prominent part of his campaign. He usually accuses Clinton of running foreign policy without firm principles and of handing a large part of U.S. decision-making over to the United Nations. Now, the United Nations has been the site of a lot of activity this week. On Monday, all day and night meetings on Palestinian issues, at night on Lebanon and Israel's bombing of Lebanon. Joining us right now to talk about the UN as part of a foreign policy debate is Phyllis Bennis. Her latest book is Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Last night, we were both at this event at American University on Bosnia, actually. It was on the media in Bosnia. And one of the people who were participating was Mira Barada, who is the legislative assistant for foreign policy to Senator Dole. And one of the things she was stressing when she was talking about whatever small differences there are between Dole and Clinton, even she agreed there aren't that many, on at least on Bosnia, she kept talking about the United Nations and the dominance of the United Nations. Where does the U.S. fit into that?
Well, I think that there's a particular problem facing the Dole campaign because of this inability to really distinguish qualitative differences of foreign policy substance between Clinton and Dole. What they've done, I think, is to stake out a more ideological position rather than a real political position on the United Nations. Essentially, what Dole is saying and what his assistant was saying last night is a sop to the right wing. It's trying to bring in the old view that the United Nations, this multilateral institution, these other people out there, and the subtext, of course, is that they are people of the third world, people of color, people not like us,
and
maybe
this,
even communists.
This one world government idea.
Exactly. That this is what has taken over Clinton's foreign policy. In fact, Clinton did come into office, of course, with a commitment to what he called aggressive multilateralism. But that commitment has been pretty much abandoned in the last couple of years. And the reality is that the United Nations remains an organization that is very much under the thumb of the United States. It is forced to play a role at times, like in Bosnia, a role of fig leaf for the inability of the major powers led by the United States to function to stop the war. At other times, particularly in the Middle East, as we saw in these meetings that happened on Monday, the United Nations is completely kept out of any real political role. Specifically, the question of allowing the Security Council to take any responsibility around the crisis in Lebanon, the United States had made very clear before the meeting was convened Monday night, the meeting that you spoke of that lasted until almost midnight that night, the U.S. had made clear that it had no intention of allowing any decision to be made, either a resolution to be passed or even a statement by the Council. That was not going to be on the agenda, and in fact, it wasn't. It was an opportunity for all the various ambassadors to give speeches, and that was all.
Now, it's interesting in both what's going on in Israel, Lebanon, Palestinian areas right now, and also what's going on in Korea, that the U.S. isn't even using the United Nations. I mean, they are in those meetings, but with the Israel-Palestinian talks resuming tomorrow between Arafat and Shimon Peres, that was brokered with Warren Christopher on the telephone, the Secretary of State. When President Clinton was in Korea yesterday, he announced some kind of four-way dialogue brokered between the United States and China that will solve the North and South Korea problem. The U.S. even seems to be going outside of the United Nations.
Well, this is not something new, Amy. I think that, as you said, there has been this tactical use in the past. It is now increasingly being abandoned by the Clinton administration. I think in this case, less for ideological than for direct political aims. The Clinton administration is in a position where it is trying to assert a greater level of strength and individual capacity on the part of this president, whose weakness is less in the substance of what he stands for in foreign policy than in the perception that he's not quite the leader that perhaps Bob Dole and the World War II generation is. And in doing so, he is, I think, rejecting the United Nations, despite his earlier commitments to it, on the basis of pure political motives, less more so than the ideological motives of Bob Dole.
Phyllis, our national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky is joining us in the studio.
Phyllis, if the Republicans by some happenstance happen to win control of the presidency, do you think that there would be, in fact, a United Nations after a Bob Dole presidency? For after all, there almost isn't right now. The United States isn't paying its bills. It's $1.2 billion in arrears.
It's actually more than that.
Is it more now every day it goes up?
Right. Well, I don't think that the United Nations is going to fade away. I think it will be less, it will be left even more hamstrung than it currently is. Its programs, particularly in the Global South, programs involving emergency care for children, worldwide inoculations of children, clean water, access of women to credit and job training and education, all those programs will be in jeopardy even more than they are now.
What about the bills, though? I mean, how are they paying their bills with this huge debt?
Well, it's getting worse and worse, and this is a major issue that we should take up in its own right at some point, I think, on this program. The question of the failure of the United States to pay its dues has been a very calculated decision by the United States that has left the World Organization, which is not allowed to borrow money, in a crisis, and the United Nations as a whole may have to close its doors, taking a lesson from the Congress by the end of this year, at least on a temporary basis. That is not any longer a hyperbolic threat by someone. It's a very clear fiscal reality.
Phyllis, let's use the example of what's going on right now in Lebanon to look at U.S. power in the United Nations. Can you describe, since you were covering the Security Council meetings on Monday, the role of the United States in shaping that debate and deciding what to do?
Well, I should say that most of what the United States does in situations like this happens before the meeting is ever convened. It happens in the background. It happens in the closed-door sessions. A formal meeting of the Security Council officially is open to the world. It's broadcast on United Nations television. All the UN journalists can watch it. But the decisions are not made there. Those are speeches. The decisions are made beforehand. In this case, the United States, as I said, made clear that there would not be any resolution passed, and there would not even be the lesser but still significant decision to issue a statement by the president of the Security Council in the name of the members of the council. In this case, there was to be only the speeches themselves. And what was very interesting was that Madeleine Albright's speech, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was very distinct from all of the others for two reasons. One, all of the other countries either focused solely on the question of the Israeli bombing, largely because Israel is seen as responsible because of its 18-year-long occupation of South Lebanon, and called for both sides to stop the hostilities. The United States distinguished itself by only calling for Hezbollah to stop the Katyusha rocket attacks across the Israeli border. It made no demands and continues to make no demands that Israel stop or even hold back on its massive bombardment of the civilian population. Beyond that, almost all of the other ambassadors spoke of the need to implement Resolution 425, which is the 18-year-old resolution passed in 1978 when Israel first occupied Lebanon. And it has been reaffirmed almost every year ever since. The United States is a signatory to that resolution. In contrast to that call for a United Nations multilateral resolution to be passed, Ambassador Albright's position was to call for direct contact between the parties, again, leaving the United Nations outside. The UN is not to be involved in this process, and her unmistakable message was, keep your hands off. This is for the United States and the parties directly. There is to be no multilateral initiative here.
Wasn't it Cuba that only objected?
Well, Cuba was the one country in the discussion that actually identified the problem and said very explicitly, and the Cuban ambassador's words were, that it appears to him that implementation of United Nations resolutions are dependent on who your friends are and how much power they wield in the Security Council. It was a very clear statement.
And of course, that resolution 425 calls on Israel to pull out of Lebanon?
Unequivocally. And of course, Israel has stated that while they ordinarily do not accept UN resolutions, they do intend to pull out. They just don't intend to do it until their terms have been met. And it has taken 18 years, and there's no end in sight.
You know, as we see in the United States, the resurgence or the growth of right-wing movements, and you've got the Montana Freeman, et cetera, they're all talking about this idea of one world government and fighting at the United Nations. Do you get calls from the press and explaining the workings of the UN, considering your new book called Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN? I'm sure most people in this country do not realize the power of the U.S. and the UN. They think of it the other way around, like Senator Dole's foreign policy aide was saying last night.
Unfortunately, Amy, I think that's a legacy of the far right-wing campaigns of the 60s and 70s, the John Birch Society and others who talked about the UN as this evil force. It's led to the current version of that has black helicopters landing in Montana to take over the United States in the name of the United Nations. The reality is the United Nations is an instrument of its most powerful member states, and of those in a world in which has only one superpower that is now unchallenged. That relationship between the U.S. and its allies exists throughout all of the world, including the United Nations. The U.S. does dominate.
You'll be perhaps not surprised to know that as I've traveled around the Southwest, especially in Arizona and Texas, I see some of those old billboards, get the U.S. out of the U.N., the ones that used to be up alongside Impeach Earl Warren. Mm-hmm. They're still there, but they got a fresh coat of paint on them. They're not left over from the 50s. They've been freshly repainted.
You know, there might be a lot of other countries that feel the same way.
For very different reasons.
For very different reasons. Phyllis Bennis, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Phyllis Bennis is author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. It's put out by Interlink Publishers, and she's also a Pacifica and WBAI reporter. Thanks for being with us on Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, we're going to move quickly now from foreign policy to local issues, and we're going to move south. Larry, you have been in the South this past weekend, and you not only were covering the Independent Progressive Party Summit that took place in Atlanta, but you were also covering the Young Democrats convention that took place there.
Right, Amy. The Young Democrats of Georgia had their annual convention this weekend, and they chose to have it in Marietta, Georgia, which just happens to be the center of Newt Gingrich's district. Nobody seems to think that Newt Gingrich is threatened with an upset by a Democrat in his district, although you never know. But what the Young Democrats in Georgia are mostly exercised about is something that Young Democrats, especially African-American Democrats across the South, are exercised about, and that is what they see as a rollback of the Voting Rights Act in 1964 and all kinds of reapportionment decisions. And this is especially critical in Georgia, where Cynthia McKinney, a very young, very outspoken, very progressive young African-American woman, has been representing a very large district, which was especially drawn in order to allow African-Americans to have representation. After Supreme Court rulings and local court rulings in Georgia, that district has now been changed entirely from a district that had 65% African Americans to only 25%. And she's running against some very strong centrist white male candidates in the primary, especially one named Comer Yates. I spoke with six young Democrats at their convention at a break that they had, and you'll hear a lot of kitchen noises in the background as we were near the kitchen in one of the dining rooms. Four of these people are college students right now. Kenneth Newby is president of the Morehouse College Young Democrats. Brandon Ivey is vice president of that group. LaTanya Gordon is at Clark University, where she's a journalism student. Heather Kavanaugh is with the Young Democrats at the University of Georgia. And then there are two recent college graduates, John Boykin, who is working on the McKinney campaign in DeKalb County, where her district is now centered, and also Myra Norman is a volunteer in DeKalb County with Cynthia McKinney. We begin the discussion with Myra Norman talking about how she reacts to the fact that Cynthia McKinney is being forced into this new electoral struggle.
I see the good old boys trying to hold on to their power and their representation and trying to keep from diffusing power.
You think she's been a threat to the good old boys?
Definitely. Definitely.
Most definitely.
Why?
Just her active voice. I see that she doesn't mind speaking her opinion on any subject. And then I see that's a problem, as she said, the good old boys. There's just some subjects they won't talk about that need to come to the table and try and provide some type of solution.
I think that it would be very naive for us to believe that the whole
situation and the issue dealing with reapportionment and redistricting was simply about the way the lines were drawn. I think a lot of it did have to do with the person that was holding position which the lines were drawn for or drawn and it benefited. I think that it's because of Representative McKinney's leadership roles that she's taken upon, that she's been in Congress, and because of the way she votes on legislation and because of the different stances she's taken on various issues that have come through Congress, which in part have also initiated this attack upon the district in the past. And I think that it's going to be a very serious issue, and it's going to have an impact unquestionably on the next election.
What kind of a message do you think it would send to the rest of the country if Comer Yates were to win the primary and Cynthia McKinney were to be defeated?
I feel that the message that will send is anybody who wants to change the current establishment or make a difference to people who have stood up against the current status quo, that this is going to discourage them. Even if you try, we're going to stop you no matter what.
Have you had a chance to be on the ground and talk to voters and go around and see what reaction is? Any of you done any precinct work? Yes.
I've had some opportunities to do like registration drives and speak with some of the African American people in the district. And they're kind of frustrated into saying, if I register, what is it going to do? Is it going to help at all? And it's a problem of trying to get people to register if they're registered to go out and vote and make a difference, because right now they feel that even if I vote, it doesn't make a difference.
Why do they feel that? Cynthia McKinney is threatened very seriously here in the primary. Can't you use that as an argument?
Well, a lot of people don't look at that. They look at the issues at hand as far as Medicaid, Medicare, welfare, education, and things like that, which they feel is more important. But I feel most important is to get the person in there that's going to represent those issues, and then you'll have a better better vote.
And even aside from voter apathy, I think a lot of voters have really become alienated from our political system in general. And a lot of that has become because of Republican attacks on a lot of legislation that benefits African Americans, to be frank. Affirmative actions come under attack in the past year. We've had redistricting the districts which represent a lot of African Americans can enjoy their representation from. I mean, 3 out of 11 districts in Georgia were represented by African Americans, and that's very significant. And it's also equally proportionate to the population that African Americans represent here in Georgia. So that's a significant thing. And when we see that come under attack, then that alienates people from the political process. Further, I mean, there are many more issues we could go on. I'm not going to go on with all the issues that have come under attack in the past year, but the impact of the totality of all of those issues causes people to have the general feeling of it doesn't matter, it doesn't mean anything no matter who I vote for. I mean, we had Cynthia McKinney in office and there was still nothing she could do to prevent the redistricting from occurring. So when people sit back and they see it, even though we have people in office who do represent us and there's still nothing being done or still think legislation gets pushed against us, then that makes them become very alienated from the political system, and that's something we need to address.
This weekend on the Clark University campus, there's a National Independent Politics Summit where people are talking about starting and supporting some sort of third-party alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. You all are here at the Young Democrats Convention. You're not over there. Is this an expression of lifetime faith to the Democratic Party, or is this, what is it?
Well, I'm ex-Young Democrat, in the fact that I think I'm past the age limit, but it was the first opportunity that I've had to attend a gathering of Democrats. And right now, you know, I think as you do age, some of your views change. I think one of the things that people have become disenchanted with the Democratic Party is what we term as social programs. And I think that needs to be reined in because it's affecting all workers. However, I just have a hard time as a young black female that's not of great financial means attaching myself to the Republican Party. At one point, if I become fabulously wealthy, I might become Republican. But until it happens, I can't see myself aligning myself with the Republicans, especially when you have people like Newt Gingrich as the leadership of the Congress.
What I was talking about, not so much attaching yourself to the Republicans, but looking at an alternative third party, whatever kind of party it may turn out to be.
And I think that's a very good, important point that you bring up. I don't really know much. It's news to me, in fact, that there's a meeting going on this weekend for the about third party. Had I known, I'm sure we would have sent a representative. Or representative to that. I don't know if the third party that they would form would be one that would represent the ideals and concerns that I have personally. So I don't know whether I could support that third party yet or not. They might be like the Republicans. They might be just like the Democrats. They might not be that much of a third party. I think there is a need for a third party in a two-party system. I've done a lot of research on that. But right now we have to deal with the reality. And the reality is for the elections coming up. And for the upcoming elections, there are only two parties.
Voices of Georgia Young Democrats at their convention this past weekend in Marietta, Georgia. And we'll hear more from them after this short break.
Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here with Larry Bensky. In just a few minutes, we're going to be going to Professor Cornel West of Harvard University. But right now, we're sticking with this conversation on the Young Democrats of Georgia.
And they're discussing next what they need to do in order to get more young people involved and indeed get people involved in general in election campaigns. As you know, young people are the least represented in the electoral system right now as far as who votes. In 1994, only 15% of the people 18 to 24-year-old who could have voted nationwide, only 15%. As you go about your work as young Democrats in your communities in the state, what do you do to talk to people? You've already mentioned it a little bit here, but what do you do to talk to people to try to convince them to get involved?
The way I see it, I've been talking to several of my peers on the University of Georgia campus, and a lot of them are very afraid of putting a label on them, you know, saying I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. People are really scared of that, and I've seen a lot of people saying, "Well, I'm an independent." They don't want to attach a label to themselves. And what I saw here this morning, people saying, you know, Ms. McKinney saying, "We need a seat at the table. You know, we need a strong voice." In the Congress, we need, the representation. You know, we need to get that across to people. We need to say to people, yes, you can be proud to be a Democrat. This is what the Democratic Party stands for. And, hopefully get some interest that way.
I think that my friends, my peers are afraid that we'll have to be there to pick up the pieces later on in our lives. And if we can show them that, no, we can start today and maybe not pick up the pieces, but start a new path that we can follow. And as terms of education, affirmative action, anything, I think we're just afraid. And if we can change that fear into something more positive.
I think there's a complacency that comes from not knowing our history and forgetting about our history. Because we see a Cynthia McKinney, because we see a Janet Reno, because we see a Dianne Feinstein, people assume that these women have always been there. They assume that people like Clinton and Gore have always been the type of people leading our country. And what they have forgotten is the fights and the struggles that came about in order for Cynthia McKinney to be a congresswoman.
I think rather than a lot of the question was, what do we do to get people involved in the political process and to vote? And I think rather than speak a lot of the rhetoric about values and ideals and things of that nature, that's not what works to get people involved in voting. For me, I found what works is making it very real for the people who you want to vote, i.e., okay, this is the type of legislation they're voting on in Congress. Last session, they voted on this, and this is how it impacts your community. This is the detrimental effect it had, and if we don't change the person in power, then look what the type of thing that happens, and it hurts you as a person in your community. Or these are the type of legislation that we need, and this person is working for it, and this is why you need to get involved and support people for legislation that could benefit you and impact you in your community. It's not about necessarily all the times, you know, look how we, you know, got the right to vote. That's significant, and we should vote because we have the right to vote and because it's an important right. But to get people involved, you have to make it real for them. You have to give them a reason why.
I see a lot of young people view politics basically as a bunch of old people making wise decisions and don't feel that we can actually make an impact. And what we've done on our campus is shown that we can by coming here, by getting involved in campaigns. And in fact, the time to pass the torch has to come sometime, whether it happens if we're in our teenage years in college or high school, or if we're in our 30s and 40s. It's going to have to happen. And we're trying to let young people know that they can get involved now, and we can have we have a large voting block for young students, and we can get involved, and that's all that young students need to know.
I just also wanted to add to what you said, Ken, about letting, for example, we had last quarter on our campus, we had a tabling, we had student aid petition, you know, for people to sign because of what the Republicans are trying to do to student aid. And I found that a lot of people really did not know the issue. And, you know, we were trying to say, this is an issue that affects you all. This is, something that affects, Georgia residents, This is your student aid, So many people, go to university because of the federal aid that we get, So I think that we need to make people aware of this is going to affect you,
Yeah, I think that's true. But then a lot of my friends have become so discouraged. It's like it's hard to get into a line. They see no way of getting, the group is already formed, and for an outsider to come in is very hard. And then a lot of times, too, is knowing the issues and how it impacts your community.
What do you say to them when they say that? It's already formed, it's a closed club, you can't do a thing about it, my vote doesn't count. You're an organizer, I assume, that's why you're here. What do you say? You look them in the eye and you say?
Well, I always say, it's someone that has to start somewhere. You can't always start at the top, and you have to work towards breaking that line, crossing it or whatever. And until we do that, things are still going to be made. Like students see school tuitions going up, and they're not being able to do anything about it. If you don't step in and voice your opinion and try and do something about it, hey, they're going to make decisions that affect you without your opinion.
I say very simply, it's better to infiltrate than to capitulate. Well, if we allow someone to say, well, they have their group and there's nothing we can do about it, we'll never get anything changed. We'll allow people and we'll allow even parties to run over us and to control our lives. If we're going to be responsible for our own destinies and take responsibility for ourselves and our counties, in our country, in our states, we have to get involved. We have to infiltrate the process. We have to infiltrate the parties. We have to infiltrate their meetings, and we can't give up.
The voices of six young Democrats at their annual state convention in Georgia, Marietta, Georgia, last weekend, Kenneth Newby and Brandon Ivey of Morehouse College, LaTanya Gordon from Clark University, Heather Kavanaugh from the University of Georgia, and two recent college graduates, John Boykin and Myra Norman. We're going to be revisiting Georgia politics tomorrow, especially the critical question of Cynthia McKinney's reelection possibilities and the primary race she has right here on Democracy Now!
And thank you for that, Larry Bensky, Pacifica National Affairs correspondent. Larry will be back tomorrow. Now, yesterday we aired an excerpt of a speech by Michael Lerner, who is editor of Tycoon Magazine, that he gave this week at a summit on ethics and meaning in Washington, D.C. More than 1,000 people came for that conference. Today we're going to air a response by Harvard University professor Cornel West. But first, a reminder of what Michael Lerner said about the politics of meaning.
Part of the whole difference of a politics of meaning in understanding the meaning needs is to say that that it is not true that the only oppressed groups in the society are those who have been economically oppressed or those who have been oppressed by virtue of the denial of their rights. That it is equally true to understand that virtually everyone in this society suffers from a form of oppression because of the way in which our capacity to be loving and caring human beings is systematically frustrated. And that is a central oppression of this reality. So to understand and really work through what a politics would be that takes that into account is really is part of what the task of a politics of meaning is.
And again, that was Michael Lerner speaking to this major conference, really. More than 1,000 people gathered. It was never expected to be so large. Cornel West, a professor at the Divinity School and the African American Studies Department at Harvard University, responded to this whole movement that is building around the country. He is also author of Race Matters and co-author with Michael Lerner of Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. He called this a kind of friendly criticism.
I'm deeply inspired by the gathering. I must say I've been wrestling with some deep sense of despair about American civilization. The more I read our history, the more I'm convinced that we're in an embryonic stage of profound decomposition and dissolution and disintegration. I say that in all seriousness. You see, I do not think that this precious, flawed, yet grand experiment in democracy will survive with the escalating levels of wealth inequality and class inequality and racial balkanization and very deep gender divisions, as well as sexual orientation, no tensions. Now, it may not be in the next 5 or 10 or 25 years, but within 50 or 75 years, something called authoritarian democracy could quite easily become predominant. And so when I see so many fellow human beings and fellow citizens who are looking for a new vision, one cannot but be excited and inspired. I want to thank Brother Michael Lerner and all of those who have worked with him in creating this kind of space. Because in many ways, for me, you see, the very fact that politics of meaning could surface at this particular moment is both a sign of something potentially to come, but it's also a sign of our desperation. Desperation not in the pejorative sense, but the sense that we know the prevailing frameworks and paradigms just don't provide us with what we need. And therefore, we have to, by trial and error, look for something new. And this actually is very American, as we know. Because one of the deep problems of American civilization is precisely that it's predicated on a collective self-definition of viewing itself as exceptional, but that American exceptionalism has rarely wanted us to be experimental about our fundamental social structures. So that ideology of exceptionalism, in which it seems as if we're so open to change, is actually a way of trumping a conversation about radically interrogating the fundamental assumptions of the system itself. And what politics of meaning is a very wise, I would say witty, but it's wise and clever and deep, and I hope seductive. It's a way of allowing a discourse to gain a certain saliency for large numbers of American citizens so that American democratic experimentalism at the deepest level can take root. Now, Brother Michael and I know we've debated for many, many, many years about this, and I've got my friendly critiques of the politics of meaning. But they're friendly. They're put forward to empower the project. because we're on the same road, we're on the same track. You see, I begin with the assumption that there's two sacred cows in American civilization, in the history of American civilization. One is economic growth by means of corporate priorities. You see. So both parties have to work within the context of economic growth, and yet the economy itself already structured in such a way that it's difficult for us to convince corporations that they have significant and substantial civic responsibilities, not just those of philanthropy and tax paying and providing jobs. We thank corporations for that. That's very kind of them. They work hard. Cutthroat competition's tough. And I say that in all seriousness. But there's got to be more. But we can't raise that question without any notion of the civic, any notion of what it means to be a citizen. But that is a sacred cow. Since the 1880s and 90s, the formation of the U.S. industrial order. And the second sacred cow are profound xenophobic sensibilities that make it difficult to talk not simply about the economic, but also the existential. And what's so distinctive about this particular movement is that it fuses the existential and the economic, the spiritual and the social, the personal and the political, learning from the sisters of all colors in the feminist and womanist movement, as they openly acknowledge. But we have to acknowledge that these structures of meaning that historically has brought people together have been profoundly xenophobic. And people get discouraged when we say, well, America has a deep white supremacist tradition and legacy. Why you say that? It makes me down. We just telling the truth, that's all. Just telling the truth. It doesn't mean we can't push it back. Think of what Miles Horton was up against. Think of what Lydia Maria Child, white sister, was up against. Think of what Brother Abraham Joshua Heschel was up against in their respective communities. They knew how deep the white supremacist sensibilities cut. But they had the courage to cut against it. And the black folk was always reminding them, you know, Jim Crow here. This is apartheid here. This is the night side of America. This is the dark side of America in more than one way. You see? But we have to be able to hit that head on. Similarly so in relation to patriarchy. And this is not a question of political correctness. I think all of us, if we're going to be democratic experimentalists, must be against any form of dogmatism. In orthodoxy, we're all ought to be for robust and uninhibited public discourse. Political correctness at its best is about suffering. Patriarchy is about suffering, scars and bruises of sisters. Homophobia is about scars and bruises of gay brothers and lesbian sisters. That's what we're keeping track of and open to a variety of different views and perspectives as to how we attempt to push it back. Now, given these two sacred cows, economic growth by means of corporate priority, deep xenophobic sensibilities, it's very, very difficult to convince significant numbers of fellow citizens that they ought to give their time and their energy and maybe their lives in their short lives to bank on an option that seems to be so far beyond the pale. Most are concerned about just getting over and trying to gain a little access to the resources. America's richest nation in the history of the world, why should I opt for the left? It's a good question. Just got one life. Because that's how new social movements are created. That's how they're created. To convince persons to so radically hit against the grain and go against the odds. That's what I find so exciting about the politics of meaning movement. You see, the possibility that there may be a new wave of social activism among fellow citizens that would accent the forms of suffering promoted by the prevailing oligarchic structure of our economy. Maybe we can get a public discourse about the distribution of wealth in our society. Now, should I mention one criticism? That's all right, brother? Yeah. And it's not really a criticism, actually. It's just that I think that we have to be just explicit about the relation of the politics of meaning to the democratic tradition and the ways in which it is a refining and deepening of the democratic tradition. And the language of democracy has not been so thoroughly co-opted by the powers that be that one does not come out and say, look, we can talk about being existential Democrats the way Whitman was, the way Louis Armstrong was, which is to say, acknowledging that non-market values play a fundamental role in our life in terms of the ways of being in the world. Love, care, concern, empathy, compassion on the individual and interpersonal level, as well as talk about being political Democrats in terms of protection of rights and liberties, economic Democrats in terms of workers having a fundamental role and significant power in the workplace, and even global Democrats that serves as a criteria to critique dictatorial regimes or various kinds of foreign policy that tend to undermine everyday people's lives in those various countries. And politics of meaning is a way of talking about all of these, but for me, I like the more explicit link to democracy, because I'm a radical Democrat. And that's precious, and it's also something that other people died for. And it connects me with them, you see. Brother Martin died because in part he was a Democrat and he loved folks so. It was in part a quest for meaning, yes, but it was for democracy in light of his own Christian view of the world that he lived and died. And if one is willing to live and die, you want to be part of that cloud of witnesses, that tradition that went before that gave so much. And so at least you want your word in the description of the label that applies to you. That's all I'm talking about. That's all I'm saying. And I'm sure Lerman will be open to that. Thank you all so very much.
Cornel West is professor at the Divinity School and the African American Studies Department at Harvard University, author of Race Matters, and co-author with Michael Lerner of Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. And he was speaking this weekend at the Summit on Ethics and Meaning that took place here in Washington, D.C. More than 1,000 people came from around the country as they launch or continue to build their movement around the politics of meaning. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 and purchase a copy from the Pacifica Archives. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! From Pacifica Radio, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman.
I like that. Did you just make that up?
We made it up at BAI a little while ago. Not bad, huh? The exception to the rulers.
Does it fit on a bumper sticker? It certainly fits on a t-shirt.
It could fit anywhere. I don't know if it fits here in Washington, though. Well, Larry Venske's with us here again, and we're also joined by our co-host in Chicago, Salim Muakil, who I'm sure has a lot of bull on his mind today. Salim, that was only meant respectfully.
Okay, I thought it was. Can you hear me?
Vaguely, but I think we're going to boost you up.
Okay.
There we are.
Okay. You can hear me now.
Yes, very well.
Oh. Is it true? Bull?
It is true, Bull. But I was going to say, Amy, it sounds like you were inspired by Cornell. with your exceptionalist mention.
That's right. I don't know which came first, me or Cornell.
Well, what's your take on Cornell West's whole approach to these questions, Salim?
I like his verbiage. I think Cornell is very poetic in the way he deals with these problems.
But he's not doing it for entertainment value.
Well, I think that's part of his purpose. And some of his analysis are pretty clear, as a matter of fact. But I'm a little bit off put by some of his leaps of context. I mean, from Kierkegaard to Public Enemy and that kind of stuff.
What puts
although
you
off about it? Although I appreciate his ability to do that, I think a lot of times it's done just for pyrotechnics.
Now, Salim, I just have to go back to what I asked you about before, lest someone think I think you only have bull on your mind without it being clarified.
Well, the Bulls just recently won 70 games, which is the highest ever of any NBA team in history.
Congratulations, Salim.
Oh, thank you. But that victory and the prominence of the Bulls in Chicago has sparked a lot of talk about the responsibilities of black athletes to their communities, the prominence of athletics in the black community. And in fact, one of the big issues today in Chicago is they're voting on local school councils. And at one particular school, King High School, which is a noted basketball power in the city, the coach is on the verge of being fired because he allegedly pressured some teachers to ease the way for some athletes, some basketball players who would make the team successful. And so the local school council, which is very heavily dominated by community people and parents, an innovation in Chicago, which is really in many ways worked and is a good example of school reform. And thus far, it seems to be working, and more people are getting involved. But anyway, these parents are pretty upset with the coach's emphasis on athletics. And in many schools in Chicago, that whole priority, that message that it's getting through to the youth that basketball is their way to success, is being questioned. And it's hard to question such wisdom with the Bulls exerting such power over the city.
But people have, I'm sure, seen Hoop Dreams around there. I mean,
yes,
I'm sure
they have.
Played for months in Chicago since it was filmed there.
It was filmed here, right.
You're familiar with the famous statement by Harry Edwards, University of California, Berkeley sociologist, I'm sure, who once said that any parents who allowed their children to go to the University of California on an athletic scholarship should be prosecuted for child abuse.
Well, yes, I've heard. You know, Harry Edwards is famous for many similar statements that are pretty controversial as well. And I think there's a lot to that. I mean, unfortunately, though, as in resource poor inner cities, all of that logic often falls on deaf ears because these young kids see very little else promising in their future. And so basketball really is something that seems to be attainable, basketball success.
You know, speaking of elections, you're talking about local school board elections, Salim, but just to let people know, here on the East Coast, Democrat Elijah Cummings became Maryland's newest Congress member yesterday, winning a special election to fill the unexpired term of Congressman Kwesi Amfume. Mm-hmm. And he became the highest-ranking black legislator in state history, Cummings did, with 80% of the vote. He was running against Republican Kenneth Condner. Now, you'd think at 20%, that would be the end of Condner, but Cummings will face him again. He's a 54-year-old dental lab owner and three-time loser against Mfume. He'll face him again in the November 5th general election to represent the 7th District in the next 2 years, because Cummings is just right now filling the unexpired term of Mfume. Mm-hmm. And, of course, mm-hmm. people know that Mfume left his fifth term to take over as president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, Salim, because I've been trying to follow, and we'll be following a lot more on this show, congressional districts around the country and how they may change. Can you give us a thumbnail idea in Illinois, how many seats are perhaps up for grabs and who might get them? Listeners should know, by way of background, we have 435 members of the House of Representatives. Maybe 80 of those seats are competitive because of gerrymandering. The one that Amy just talked about in Maryland, that guy can serve till he dies. I mean, he's got 80% guaranteed Democratic vote in that Center City Baltimore district. And that's true, Republicans and Democrats around the country in about 350 of the 435 districts. But there are some that are in play, and I know some are in Chicago. For example, the one that Rostenkowski used to have, which was won by now Republican Congressman Flanagan. How does that one look?
Well, it looks kind of even money at this point. There's a guy named Lavoyevich, who's a patron, so to speak, of one of the more powerful Chicago politicians, Alderman Mel, and it seems that he will inherit some of the vestiges of the machine, because Mel is still pretty much a smooth operator in the old Chicago political sense. You know, one of the more significant happenings in the city is the fact that now it appears that we'll have three very progressive members of Congress serving from Chicago. Jesse Jackson Jr. It looks like Danny Davis will probably win in the 7th congressional district, and Bobby Rush, who's a former Black Panther and is considered, you know, pretty progressive on most issues. So that's going to be a troika of significant import who will be serving, and they will be in concert quite a bit. And also, you know, Dick Durbin's senatorial race against a guy named Al Salvi, who upset the Republican establishment's candidate, and went on who's Bob Cusper. And he went on to win the Republican primary, and he and Durbin will go against each other in November. And that promises to be a pretty, pretty exciting campaign. And it looks like Durbin has the edge here. And Durbin is a relatively progressive senator, much in the style of Senator Simon. In fact, Simon endorsed him strongly.
I remember Durbin from last year when we were doing 100 Days of Congress and I was covering Congress. Dick Durbin was very vocal in his support of the Food and Drug Administration, really going after a lot of the corporate front groups that were representing industry, trying to prevent, you know, people from being able to sue if they've been hurt by medical devices or by pharmaceuticals. But he was extremely vocal on that issue.
You mentioned the three progressive African-Americans now in Congress from Chicago. Let me ask you something. Are there any African-Americans who have a chance of winning, running in any districts that are not majority African-American in Illinois? And I bring this up because I just got back from Georgia, where this is, as you know, a big issue.
Big issue, right, with
voting rights case, right, and Cynthia McKinney. And people saying in the South, well, what they're doing is the second rollback of Reconstruction, that they are taking away Black seats, making Blacks into what Cynthia McKinney calls spare parts for the white people to get elected to Congress again. And the conventional wisdom is that Black people will always vote for white Democratic candidates, but whites will not vote for progressive Black candidates. Is there any races in Illinois shaping up where that's going to be tested?
No, not really. Not in Illinois. Not that I know of. And but there is, in the Latino community, there's some... some controversy developing now around Luis Gutierrez's district, which is being questioned along the same lines of Cynthia McKinney's. Although there have been no explicit suits filed, there's a lot of talk about potential suits. But that Gutierrez is perhaps the only district that is threatened in that same way. Most of the Chicago representatives who are serving now are in solidly African-American districts.
You know, we were going to have on in this segment Jesus Garcia, a state senator from your area, from Chicago, and we were hoping we'd be able to get him, first American, Mexican-American, to be elected to the Illinois Senate. But it doesn't prevent us from actually discussing the issue that we were going to, Salim, something that has been on your mind, something we've been touching on Democracy Now!, and it is the issue of police brutality, particularly in communities of color, in Latino communities and African-American communities. Why don't you talk a little about what you've been looking at?
Well, you know, when sheriff's deputies in Riverside were captured on videotape clubbing a Mexican man and woman, you know, it immediately evoked these memories of 1991 and Rodney King, who was treated similarly. But what those two incidents reveal more than anything else is how African-Americans and Latinos share concern about police abuse, and those issues. But more than that, it symbolized and seemed to offer a golden opportunity for two of this country's largest minority groups to begin to kind of cultivate the nationwide coalitions that would help us be more effective in public policy and influencing public policy. And unfortunately, though, from what I've been hearing in California, I want to ask Larry about this a bit. It has yet to encourage those kinds of coalitions. There doesn't seem to be the desire to merge the concerns of the African American and Latino communities. Is that
well,
true, Larry?
Yes and no. There will be. One of the problems is you have conventional politicians, Salim, just like you were talking about before, who have their own districts where they're safe and where the electorates don't overlap, which have been gerrymandered just for that reason. But I think you may see a big change this fall with the so-called California Civil Rights Initiative on the ballot in November, because this is one, like it or not, that a lot of Latino activists and African-American activists and women activists are going to be thrown into the same cause together. And if that initiative is to be defeated, and of course it's an initiative aimed at destroying affirmative action in any form, there's going to have to be an effective coalition among those groups.
So you do see that particular issue as drawing those groups together?
It's already happened. One of the things that may help defeat this initiative is that the people who tried to put it on the ballot telegraphed it long in advance, which gave the opposition to it a long time to organize. And I've been at a number of meetings, and I know a lot of people have gone even more than I have, many more than I have, where I have seen in the same room people from the Latino and from the African-American communities. The question is, will the politicians bring along their districts? And you know, one of the hidden aspects of American electoralism, and I know this is just as true in Illinois, maybe even more so than it is in other places like California, is you have people with safe districts, and so they don't care to increase the voter turnout in their districts. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you've got a safe Latino or a safe black district, you know you're going to get elected with 75 or 80% of the vote. How much time are you going to spend on voter registration? Mm-hmm. Or how much time are you going to spend on getting out the vote? You don't need to.
Right.
Well, now they need to, because those votes count statewide, not just in the district if you're voting against CCRI, or for on the other hand, if you're trying to get Bill Clinton elected. So we are going to have to see some sort of really strong grassroots effort helped by these, in many cases, can I say, very lazy incumbents. And this is not, of
you
course,
can say that, Larry.
I hasten to say, Latino and black representatives. It's true in overwhelmingly white districts, too, where the people, congressmen, it's not in their interest to get bigger turnouts. Why do they care?
And that, in fact, was one of the refreshing aspects of, is one of the refreshing aspects of Jesus Garcia. One of the reasons why I thought he'd be a good person to talk to is because he really is pushing for a continued expansion of the electoral base and for serious coalitions between Latino and African Americans in state government and in city government in Chicago.
You know, Salim, we see that coalition also building in New York. A couple weeks ago, the Puerto Rican March on Washington that happened had about 1,000 people. I do admit that day it was snowing in Washington, not exactly Puerto Rican weather. In New York, the night before that march, there were also more than 1,000 people just in New York alone. It was led by the National Congress of Puerto Rican Rights, protesting police brutality. Mm-hmm. People of all colors out there marching through the streets of New York. And this is a coalition that's certainly building there. We want to thank you, Salim, for joining us. We're sorry that State Senator Jesus Garcia wasn't able to make it. I assume he's caught in traffic, and we do hope to have him at a future point. Salim Wakil, thanks for joining us from Chicago. Salim is a senior editor at In These Times, and he's a columnist with Chicago Sometimes, and he is a co-host on Democracy Now! And Larry, thanks again for being with us, and you'll be back tomorrow. Larry's with us in Washington, D.C. this week, so it's very good to have you. And folks, we are hoping that you will call in and write in and let us know what you're thinking. Yesterday, we said we'd give you our address, our street mail address. We have moved, and we do look forward to your letters. Our address is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Washington, D.C., 2009. That is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Washington, D.C., 2009. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Thanks to Don Rush. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can Call us at 1-800-735-0230 to copy a purchase of today's or any show of Democracy Now! Or the Pacifica Network News. That's 1-800-735-0230. I want to thank you very much for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!